I'm Lisa Davis. Welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM. In the light of escalating costs of health care in the U.S. and the ongoing debate about appropriate health insurance reform, it's easy to forget about the human side of medicine and the importance of the doctor-patient relationship. This is not forgotten by today's guest, Dr. Larry Levitt, a neurologist and the co-author of Uncommon Wisdom, True Tales of What Our Lives as Doctors Have Taught Us About Love, Faith, and Healing. In Uncommon Wisdom, along with co-author, neurologist Dr. John Castalto, they share what they have learned in their many years as doctors, not just from tests and labs, but from years of listening and learning from their patients. Dr. Levitt, welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, I'm so glad to have you on the program. I was so moved by the stories in your book, and in the introduction of Uncommon Wisdom, you write, quote, looking back, we realize that the uncommon wisdom that our patients have shared with us is founded on the values that our parents once tried to teach us at a time when we were not ready to truly listen. What were those, or what are those values?
Well, there are many, and we, in fact, did learn them from our parents. The values include listening. You don't learn a lot from talking, so we have learned better and better over the years to listen to our patients. They taught us about how to face tragedy. They taught us about how to have hope even when things look bleak. They have taught us to basically have an optimistic attitude towards life, and that's shared by both John Castaldo, my buddy and co-author, for years. And we've learned from those lessons. And I think it's made us better doctors and better people.
Oh, I wish you were my doctor, although I do love my doctor. But do you think that, you've been practicing medicine since the 1967, was it around there?
Well, that's when I trained, but I actually started practice in 1972. But I had 30 years as a clinical neurologist with John Castaldo, and on purpose we shared the same desk, as you saw in the introduction.
Yes.
Not many doctors do that, but we did that on purpose so that we bumped into each other all the time and shared information about multiple sclerosis and Parkinson's disease and epilepsy. But what we also learned is we were learning about life from our patients, and we shared that information with each other.
Yeah, do you think doctors today, now, I worry that there's so many people, in and out, and the patients are triple booked, and you're in there, and it's like, how are you, and you talk for a second, and then they go on to the next person, and it seems like it's going to be harder to learn those lessons if the office visits are so short and there's not as much time. What changes have you seen?
Well, that's a real challenge, especially nowadays with managed care, and a place called Massachusetts, which you may have heard about, has a particular problem.
Yes.
Because there, and the good news is that more and more people have been accepted and have insurance, but the bad news is there are fewer and fewer primary care physicians to take care of them. So the lines are long and the waiting lists are long, et cetera, and the amount of time that you can spend is restricted. So we need to fix that problem. And I know Governor Romney actually did a long way towards doing that, and now they're trying to do it nationally. But you can't restrict someone to 11 minutes for a patient when he may have three or four problems, and you also need to be able to talk to him about what's really bothering you. So it's a challenge. I hope that the current healthcare reform will, in fact, allow more time as well as attention and kindness to your patients, which I must say was easier years ago than it is now. It's a real challenge.
Yeah, well, in your book, Uncommon Wisdom, it's broken into six chapters, Enriching Connections, Humble Listening, Going the Distance, Sorrows, Lessons, Love Heals, and Leaps of Faith. And I've chosen one story from each chapter. And Enriching Connections, you write a story about being a first-year resident at Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. And you write, quote, I was 27 years old and green to the gills, stuffed with textbook knowledge, but not much experience with actual patients, much less families. And you tell a story about how you were helping this nice couple, Dorothy and Leonard Poole. Were you helping Dorothy? And Leonard was, said he wanted to speak with you, and you felt kind of nervous. What did you think he was going to say, and what did he actually say?
Well, that's a story that is very close to my heart, and I don't want to spoil it for your readers, but basically involved me knowing nothing. I was a first-year resident. I had just graduated from a medical school, and I really literally knew nothing. Thank God there was a senior doctor at Memorial Sloan Kettering whose name was Dr. Geller, and he directed me to try to help figure out what was wrong with Mrs. Poole, whose name, of course, I didn't know. And in fact, he did that. I went to the library and figured out that this poor lady who was moribund and could hardly lift her head off the bed, had her weakness because her sodium was low, sodium being one of the electrolytes in the blood. And when we restricted her water intake, she got up and walked around the room. It's like a miracle. Well, before that happened, my wife Eva, about which there is a special chapter called Listen to Eva, I learned to listen to her. Are you married, Lisa?
Oh, yes. It'll be 10 years this year.
Yeah, well, tell your husband he should listen to you. And
I'm going to have him listen to this.
If he needs support, he needs to read that chapter. So Eva said, bring him home for dinner, because he was sleeping on the couch on the eighth floor, and we were sure that from Allentown, Pennsylvania, that he couldn't afford a room and certainly not a meal in Manhattan. So we brought him home. She made chicken for him and carrots. I'll never forget that. And he was very appreciative of that. And meanwhile, his wife was getting better. So after she was discharged back to Allentown, I got a call to Memorial Sloan Kettering's president, whose name is Mr. Vanderwalker. And I was sure that I was fired, Lisa. I mean, why would a resident be called to the president's office?
Wow.
I walked into the office, and I was shaking, and he said, are you Levitt? I said, I am. He says, first of all, stop shaking. Everything is okay. I said, all right. He says, well, Mr. Poole was just here, and he appreciated the care that you and Dr. Geller gave his wife, Dorothy. And he just gave us $1 million.
Wow.
Well, I almost fainted. Well, it turns out he wasn't poor. And he could have afforded a hotel room, but he slept on the couch because he loved his wife. And I then learned that he was the founder and CEO of Air Products and Chemicals, which is one of America's major companies, which has its headquarters still in Allentown. And he was trying to be a good husband. So that began a relationship that I had with him when he followed my career, and I wound up in Allentown, Pennsylvania, because it turns out they needed a neurologist. So that's a good story about don't judge a book by its cover. You've heard that. It's a cliche. But in fact, I did. I said, he can't afford a hotel room. He can't afford a meal. And Eva said, bring him home for dinner. So I did.
Oh, gosh. You know, speaking of Eva, you'd mentioned the listening to Eva. And you know, that really talks about listening to your wife's intuition. I like what you said earlier about listening to women. And you had written something about why are women such persistent worriers? And then it turned out the thing that she was worried about was that, you know, actually came to fruition. And it goes beyond that, too, just about, I think, listening to your own intuition and listening to your patients, which you mentioned in the beginning of the interview. And if you can touch on that a bit.
Yeah, we learn a lot from our patients and have learned particularly from our patients when hope looks bad. For example, one of the stories that apparently you have read and liked is A Vigil for Anna.
Yes.
And Eva's grandmother, who was fortunate enough to survive Auschwitz in Queens years later, fell ill with a fever of 105 and a rash and went into shock. And we brought her to the New York hospital where I was a fourth-year student, not because I knew what to do, but I knew that she needed more help than I could provide. So she came to the New York hospital where the senior doctor basically gave up on her, as you may recall.
Mm-hmm.
Because he said she's 80 years old, she has a rash, she has a fever, she's in shock. And Larry, if you want to, you could go across the street, and when it's over, we'll call you. When it's over, that was shorthand for when she dies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, her daughter, who was there, said, I can't believe that we have to let her die. So the intern in the case, Tim Weld, who, by the way, is still around, and it's actually a neighbor of yours in Nantucket now, because he's retired, and I've been in touch with him, stayed up all night, figured out what was wrong with her, I don't want to spoil it,
and
put her on the right antibiotic, and she walked out of the hospital and lived for 10 years. And we learned from that women's intuition, whether from Eva or from Mother, is very important, and don't give up too quickly. So Tim Weld, whom I called about 2 years ago when we were finishing the chapter, and I found him because he was the only internist with that name in Manhattan. He called me back. I said, do you remember the case of Anna Roth? He said, not only do I remember the case of Anna Roth, I married the student nurse who took care of her. True story. So anyway, he's now in Nantucket. He's invited me to come up and go fishing with him, which I plan to do. And maybe, who knows, maybe he's even listening to this program. But intuition is important. Eva saved the life, basically, of a family doctor who I still know, who became quadriplegic in the snow, you'll recall.
Yes.
And she thought they missed something at the hospital when they said they couldn't find out what was wrong. And I talked about that case with the still chairman of neurology at the Brigham, whose name is Marty Samuels. And he said, Larry, you go back and do another test because I think they did miss a disc. And in fact, they did. And when I went back and did a what was then a myelogram, which we don't do much anymore, there was a disc sitting on this gentleman's Stan, we call him Stan's spinal cord. And when that was removed, he in fact has been fine ever since. So intuition, women's in particular, is not to be made light of.
Yeah, you know,
so tell your husband that, Lisa. Tell him that he
will.
Should listen to you.
I sure will. Now, excuse me. You know, in that chapter, listening to Eva, you also write, quote, the research is clear about this. Doctors are actually less likely than the general public, because Stan is a doctor, to get regular physical examinations or to submit to the kinds of screening tests that can uncover problems before they could become disasters. And you ask a great question. As medical experts and healers, do we feel somehow magically protected from death and disability ourselves? Do you or did you at that time?
I personally no longer do. I think I probably suffered from that problem before I was confronted with several cases, including a very close friend of mine who, as you know, wound up committing suicide because he was troubled and I didn't pick it up. He was depressed, and I hope everyone who's listening will look into the eyes of people who they see every day, and if they see something that doesn't fit right, say, how are you doing? But the second time that happened, as you recall, I was able to, with the help of a psychiatrist friend, save the life of a colleague of mine, who, by the way, is still fine. But I don't do that anymore. I get regular physicals. I have some minor health problems, which are now being addressed. And doctors have this macho thing, which they need to get over, because there are simple things that we need to do, both doctors, nurses, and others, to protect themselves. I hope we're all getting breast self-examination and mammography if we are women.
Mm-hmm.
I hope if we have children, we're not letting them smoke. 3,000 kids start smoking every day, Lisa.
That is
every day in America. Can you imagine? And it's still the number one cause of cancer death in women. Breast cancer is more common, but 50% of women who get breast cancer survive, but 90% of women who get lung cancer die. So there is a lot of stuff in there that we hope that other people will take seriously, especially medical students and residents, but the general public. There's stuff that you can do to keep yourself healthy.
Oh, there sure is. You know, and I just going back to that about, you know, feeling like the medical experts and healers are magically protected, do you think that it could also be that there's just some sort of fear because they see firsthand how difficult dealing with illnesses and other, you know what I mean? Like, they're in the trenches. They see it. And
I know exactly what
you
feel, but that's not a reason not to get a checkup. That's not a reason if you feel something abnormal, not to say, gee, it could be serious. I'm afraid to look into it, you know. Women particularly, I hope, because this is so close to my heart. I had three sisters, all of whom died from breast cancer, three out of three.
Sorry.
And that has made me very sensitive to that and the importance of breast self-examination and mammography when it's indicated, and pursuing that further, because more than half of women can now be saved if they get proper screening and do proper testing for breast cancer. So anyway, a word to the wise. You have a lot of wise listeners, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. So I think that is so important. And, you know, that's the thing. Like, things can happen at any time. And in the section, Sorrow's Lessons, you know, you share a story about a family that loses their 19-year-old son. And you write, quote, we wrap ourselves in illusions of safety, not knowing how close we walk to the edge. And I thought that was so beautifully put about you just never know. I just interviewed an amazing man, Francesco Clark, who at 24 dove in a pool. He thought it was a deep end. It wasn't. And he became a quadriplegic. And he's done all kinds of experimental surgeries. He does therapy 5 hours a day. He has a lot of upper body movement. He's come a long way. He's an ambassador to the Christopher Reeve Foundation. But again, he was working for Harper's Bazaar magazine. He was just out of college. His whole life was ahead of him. And then boom, you know.
And the boom didn't have to occur if he had thought, unfortunately, a little bit more carefully. I have a I have a very close friend whose nephew is quadriplegic from jumping into a pool. And the story that you talk about from Uncommon Wisdom called Walking the Edge is very close to my heart, because I shut off the ventilator on that young man who went to a place called Harvard College. You may have heard of it. And he had just been home. I'm only kidding, of course. He was accepted there after getting 800 on his college boards in high school, was home on his first weekend to Allentown, Pennsylvania, walking around the park when he was struck by a bicycle, suffered a subdural hematoma, a clot on the brain, and died. So that devastated his family, but what his family did with that tragedy, I think, is very special. Without spoiling it, the mother went back, got a PhD in psychology, and her specialty now is helping families who have had tragedies. So their whole family life was changed, never to be, of course, forgotten. But the father became much more charitable and established an institute in this boy's name in Israel. And we're still very close to that family. But how tragedies can change lives is illustrated in that chapter called Walking the Edge.
Yes, you know, and the last thing that I wanted to mention is about Dr. Castaldo's chapter about his son, David. I mean, talk about a tragedy. And again, I don't want to give anything away, but just what he had gone through and sort of going from being a doctor to a patient's loved one opened his eyes to some hard realities, and that he saw that sometimes, you know, the doctors send someone else to go and talk to the family and they don't always make time. And again, I'm not maligning all doctors by any means, but I thought that was an interesting experience for him to be on the other side.
Thanks, Lisa. I have to compliment you. I've been interviewed before, but it sounds like you're the one who has read the book most carefully.
You should see all the books. They're all highlighted and underlined.
Thank you. John Castaldo is a dear friend, and the good news, without spoiling it, is that boy did come out of the hospital after being in coma, after John going in there day after day and saying, David, are you okay? And got no response. And then one day said, David, are you okay? And David showed two fingers and a victory sign.
It's so amazing. Well, the book is wonderful. Uncommon Wisdom, True Tales of What Our Lives as Doctors Have Taught Us About Love, Faith, and Healing. I wish all doctors were like you. You have such a wonderful spirit and energy. And Dr. Levitt, how can people learn more about you and your wonderful work?
Well, they can learn about the book, actually, by going to Amazon and reading the 5 out of 5, which are 5-star. We were very thrilled with that. Today is, I don't know if this is live, but today is Tuesday, the 29th. The New York Times has a special thing about the book on the front page of its health section. And they can look to Rodale.com. And learn about the book. But anyway, if they really like the book, they can send me an email at llevitt@rcn.com, and I will try my best to answer it.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Levitt. And if people want to reach me, they can go to itsyourhealthradio.org. Everyone have a great week. Take care. Bye-bye.